This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. Value Hive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive. All right. So the man who needs no introduction lately, Morgan Housel. He is a writer and investor at the Collaborative Fund, and he's also the author of it's now a New York Times bestseller. It was up in the, I think it was number one, but I think it's still in like the top five or top 10, Psychology of Money.
Yeah. There's different categories that it's in. It's in investing category, budget management. So it bounces around, but it's been fairly good. I mean, a lot of finance books are hard to sell because they seem like work for people. It seems like, look, people are interested in it, but a lot of finance books are basically textbooks. They're hard to understand, giving you advice that you don't want to hear. So I've been pleased so far with how it's going, but most books, basically all books are like a seed stage startup where very few of them work. And even a lot of the good ones, like the odds are stacked against you. So it's hard to get a book to work. So far it's been good, but fingers crossed, we'll see what happens from here.
Yeah. And this is your first book that you've published, correct?
It's my first real book. Several years ago, I wrote a bunch of basically long form blog posts that we turned into Kindles. So those were quote unquote books, but this is the first capital B book. Yes.
Nice. Well, I mean, look, for seed venture, seems like you're turning into a unicorn at this point.
We'll see. Fingers crossed.
So you said that most finance books are like work to read. I can attest to that. Now, in terms of writing it, coming from a writer to a writer, what was the most challenging part about writing the book that people might not understand looking, going beneath the surface?
Well, here's the thing. I read a lot of books. You probably read a lot of books. Most of your listeners do as well. But I don't finish a lot of books. The majority of, like, maybe, I mean, I haven't measured, but maybe like 1 in 10 books do I actually read to the last chapter. Even books that I like, books that I recommend to people, a lot of times I read 3 chapters and I say, okay, I've gotten the point. It's a good point. I learned from the point, but I got the point. I don't need anything else. Which is just to say that very few books actually require 250 pages to get your point across. They could have been long form articles, magazine articles. Some of them could have been tweets. You made one point. It's a good point, but you don't need a book to get your point across. So it was important for me when I set out to write this that, look, the metric that I want to maximize for, it's impossible to measure this. I'll never know, but I want people to finish the book. I want people to read to the end. Because I wanted there to be as little rambling in there as possible. So how I structured it is rather than making one point that I rambled on for 250 pages, the book is 20 separate points, 20 short chapters. And all of them, kind of go into depth and tell a story because that's what the luxury that you have in a book. But I hope there's minimal rambling in there. There's one chapter in the book that's one page long. It's interesting, when I turned it into the publisher, they said, oh, is this a mistake? There's only one page. It's less than a page. It's like half a page.
Wow.
And I told the publisher, said, no, that's all I have to say on this topic. It's an important topic, but this is all I have to, like, I made my point. And I, out of respect for the reader, I'm done here. And they said, well, do you want to add to it? You want to add, tell a story? And I said, no. Out of respect for the reader. And because I myself am a reader myself.
Right.
That's all I want to say. So I hope that there. So, anyways, the question was the challenge of it. The challenge for a book is always to go deep and in depth and be able to tell a story, but being as succinct as possible and making your point and getting out of the way. That's the hardest part about a book. When you have the luxury to write a bunch of stuff, you want to be still as succinct as possible.
Right. And it's always a struggle, right? Because you want to form a narrative and you want to form this story, but at the same time, you don't want to have the details crowd out the actual meat of the story.
Right. And look, there's a difference between being succinct and being short. Being short, or being, making your point clearly does not always mean that it's a short book. I use the example of Doris Kearns Goodwin, the famous presidential historian, wrote a book on FDR that I read a couple years ago. And the book is 1,000 pages long. And I read to the end. And in 1,000 pages, she does not waste a single sentence. It's the perfect example of being succinct does not mean short. It's a 1,000-page book. It's so, like, every paragraph you learn something from. There's no rambling. And so you can go into depth, but very few topics require that. Like the life of Franklin Roosevelt does require that. But most topics, if you're talking about behavioral finance, if you're talking about compounding, you're talking about interest rates, whatever it is, you should be able to make your point quickly and get out of people's way. Because most people just, they want to learn, they want to listen to a cool story, but they're busy. So tell them your cool story quickly and then get out of their way. That's always what I want for writing, both in articles and a book.
Now, when writing this book, did you find anything about your writing that you realized was like a weaker point for you that you had to refine over the course of writing the book? Because I know, you know, as writers, we're always trying to get better at something, and there's no, you know, I made it here. Was there something that you were struggling with through writing the book that you actually overcame towards the end?
Here's one thing that's interesting on that point. I had a year to write this from the time I signed with the publisher. I told him I'll turn this into you in 1 year.
Yeah.
And after 9 months, 9 months into that year, I had written 2 chapters, one of which did not even make it into the book. So after 9 months, wow. I had done like nothing. And it was because I had the time to procrastinate. When you have a year in front of you, you think, I'll chip away at this slowly. And I'd gotten like nothing done. And after 9 months, it was my wife who was basically like, are you even writing a book? Like what's going on there? You haven't gotten anything done. And that was my push to basically clear my calendar, completely clear everything off. And I worked on the book for 4 weeks straight. I did nothing else. I was writing 6 days a week, like 6 in the morning till 7 at night, just like cranking on the book, and got 90% of the book done in those 3 or 4 weeks. And to me, that was just an indication of something I was known about myself, but I think this is true for almost everyone else, is that if you have the opportunity to procrastinate, you will procrastinate. So it was important for me because my whole career, I've been on the blog treadmill of, I got to publish every week, short turnaround. If I don't publish every week, people will forget about me kind of thing. There's always like a push to publish now, quick, get it out. But once I had the opportunity for a book to take my time, I just procrastinated. So for book number 2, which I'm going to start writing here fairly soon, that's just a lesson for me. That book too, I have 1 year to write it. And now I just know from the get-go that I'm probably going to write all of it in the last 3 months. And rather than beating myself up over that, I think I'm just okay with it and I accept it.
Yeah, I was about to say, just like a part of me just got anxious and like, you know, the hair stood on my back when you said you had a year and then you waited and, you know, basically wrote the whole thing in 4 months. It's just, but at the same time, I mean, going even back to school and all this stuff, you know, some people at least tend to do better under procrastination and under those really tight deadlines.
Yeah. Because during those 3 or 4 weeks where I was doing nothing else, the only thing on my mind at all was book. And since I was so focused on it, it was always in my head and I would wake up with new ideas. And I would be going for a walk in the middle of the day and I'd come up with new ideas for the book because nothing else was on my mind. Versus before, in the previous 9 months, I was chipping away at it. My plan was, okay, every Friday afternoon, I'll spend a couple hours on the book. But because of that, I had a bunch of other stuff on my mind. I had other projects that I was working on, other work obligations. So I wasn't actually focused on it. So that to me, like, that's why people procrastinate. It's not necessarily a function of laziness. I think it's a function of focus. You get things done at the last second because then you only have enough time to focus on one thing, which is actually great. And that's when you do your best work.
Your book is about the behavioral aspect of money and kind of how people feel about money and how they interact with money. When investors read this book, what kind of insights can they get into their own investing life and maybe their own psychology around investing? And the way I want to think about this, and, you know, forgive me if this is kind of, you know, rambled, but it's trying to unravel it in my brain. There's this thought that rising stock prices is, you know, a good thing, and you see your 401k rising all the time. But in reality, if you're a long-term investor, you actually favor price declines over the short term, which means that, you know, the future is being discounted and you can buy it at a cheaper price. How does this book help reconcile those two seemingly combative thoughts?
Well, I think if there's two big takeaways from the entire book, and again, there's 19 or 20 separate points that are made with short stories, but if there's two big common denominators from the book, it's something like this. The cost of admission to long-term success in the stock market is putting up with uncertainty and variation and randomness. That's what you have to be able to put up with and endure in order to achieve long-term returns. That's the first point. The second point is that all of us think about risk differently. I think about risk differently than you do, even if you and I are just as smart as one another and just as informed as one another, because I've had a different life than you have, and everyone else has. Everyone has different background, different upbringing, different generation. Even if you and I are from the same generation, we grew up in different parts of the country. Our parents had different values and whatnot. It's true for everybody. So we go through life thinking about risk and opportunity and goals and what we want out of life, what we want out of money in very different ways. And because of that, I think there, for most financial problems that we have in our life, discussions, there's no one right answer. It's not like math where 2 + 2 = 4 for me and you and everyone else. It's not right. like that in finance. What I should do with my money is going to be different from what you do. So therefore, a lot of times when we see like a debate in investing where people are debating about, is this the right thing to do with your money? Is this a good strategy? Yes or no? A lot of times people aren't actually debating. They're just reflecting that they have different views of the world. They have different goals and whatnot. There's a point that I make in the book that rather than trying to be rational with our money and aiming to be rational, aiming to do things that make sense on the spreadsheet or that the formula tells us is the right thing to do, we should aim to just be reasonable with our money. Rather than trying to do the textbook perfect thing, just do what works for you. What works for your goals, your risk tolerances, what helps you sleep at night. If it works for you, then that's great. I think it's kind of similar to health and diet in the sense of, look, there is a textbook perfect diet, right? You should drink tap water and eat vegetables and eat that. And there's like a perfect thing, but no one, like very few, if anyone, is going to do the perfect rational diet. They're going to do the reasonable diet. They're going to eat the best as they can, which is going to include some ice cream and some beer. Even if that's not rational to eat, it's a reasonable thing to eat. So if it works for you and makes you happy, then that's great. I think it's the same for investing. There are things that I do with my money that people would criticize and say, that's not the rational thing to do. And will ask me, Morgan, how do you justify that decision you made with your money? And most of the time I'd say, I can't, I don't feel any need to justify it to you on paper.
Right, exactly.
Because it works for me, it works for my wife. That's what we want to do. And you should do the same thing with your money, even if I were to disagree with it.
And it's funny because we're almost getting to a point that I wanted to talk about earlier, but do you think the investment community is too focused on trying to change people's minds and trying to convince people about certain things instead of just saying, hey, look, here's a framework for how I think about a company or for how I think about a business model. This is just how I'm thinking. Instead, it's, you know, this company is undervalued. You need to buy this. This company is overvalued. You need to buy it. It seems like there's a lot of convincing and not framework analysis.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. And the biggest issue with saying you need to buy this, which, you know, is generalizing, but that tends to be the information that's out there, particularly if you're going on financial television or something. And the big question, if someone were to hypothetically say you should buy Netflix stock, the question is, well, who are you? Are you a 17-year-old day trader? Are you a mutual fund manager who is graded on the next quarter? Are you a 90-year-old widow on a fixed income? Like, because that advice to buy Netflix stock might be the best advice for one person and disastrous for another. So the idea that we're all playing different games, we all have different goals, different outlooks, different tolerances, but we tend to still view, like I said, financial information like it is math or like it's physics, that it's a rule of law in the world that is going to be true for everyone, that is like this immutable law, when it's not. I love the quote from a financial advisor named Tim Maurer who says, personal finance is more personal than it is finance. I think that's great. I think that should be like a central philosophy of how we think about money. That it's, I think like one other analogy maybe is something like relationships. Like what is the textbook definition of a good partner, a good boyfriend, a good girlfriend, a good husband, wife? Yes, there are common denominators, but what some people like and prefer is very different from what other people like and prefer. So, you know, I have friends, everyone who has friends who cannot understand how they picked the spouse that they did. Everyone knows someone like that. But if it works for you, if it works for you guys, then great, great. What works for me, works for me. And what works for you, works for you. I think that's how it should be. So I think that is a huge point in finance that you're right. When we're talking about advice, I think virtually all financial advice has to be viewed through your own individual lens. And when we try to make things common for people and try to have like the most broad advice possible, it gets very difficult, which is why in this book, you know, there's no specific advice that says you should do this. It's just trying to help you understand how to think about it in your own way through your own lens.
Yeah, it's funny. A few years ago, I used to work at a RIA in Baltimore. It was actually my first boss in the business. And I remember sitting in his office and I was just talking to him. I was like, why don't clients understand, you know, hey, this is a good business. It's trading at a discount. If you look out over the next 5 years, it should be earning way more cash than it is today. And he just said, Brandon, one thing you have to understand is that this business is way more being a psychologist than it is being a good investment analyst. And it just hit me. It didn't make sense because I was obviously naive to this idea that you have to, you know, walk clients through and all that stuff. But no, it just kind of reiterates what you just said. I do want to ask you one question before we kind of go into your writing from 0 to 1 and how you got started in the Motley Fool and all that. Something I've always wanted to ask you is if there was any topic that you wanted to read in a book that hasn't been written yet, So is there anything that you would like to read from a book that hasn't been written yet? What would that topic be?
You know, I've written some about this, but not nearly enough. And this might seem odd to people, but I think it's a really fascinating topic. I'm into World War II history because I think that period just had the greatest amount of obviously suffering and just uncertainty than of any other documented period that we have. So I'm learning about that, I think, has always been fascinating to me. And like any other tragedy or any other war, I should say, it is by and large written through the victor's eyes, is viewed right through the eyes of the Allies. There's one book that I read called D-Day Through German Eyes, which is just what you would expect. It was the view of how the Normandy invasion took place through the eyes of the surviving Nazi soldiers. What did they see? What did they experience?
Wow.
We rarely hear that experience because no one wants to hear from the losers, of course, particularly from a side that was so morally evil. But it's a fascinating view because their view of what happened is completely different from the Allied view. So I'm fascinated in World War II, but I want to read more about the experience through the loser's eyes because it is so different from our eyes. Let me give you one point that I found so fascinating from that book. They're interviewing these Nazi soldiers who at the time were kids, effectively. They were, you know, these are not politicians who are planning the strategy. These are kids who are pulled off of a farm in Germany and handed a rifle and said, go fight for your country.
Right.
But they're interviewing them, and these German soldiers said they could not understand why the Americans were so angry at them. They said, look, I know this is a war, but why are you so mad at us? Because from their perspective, they were the protectors, the guardians of Europe, and the Americans were the invaders. And you read something like that and your head just explodes with this idea of how, how powerful propaganda is, how influenced other people can be. And look, that's a very specific example, but I'm always fascinated in just how people view the world through a different lens. And that is a lens that, of course, was a wrong lens. That's hard to understand, but that's what they believe. That's what a lot of them in that situation believe, just a very different view of what was going on that I find so fascinating.
And you know what's so funny is I was just thinking about this too, because I don't know if it's the environment we're in right now in terms of, you know, the stocks always go up mentality, but it seems like the investment success stories are only written by the survivors, obviously, because you have tweets who are saying, you know, hey, if you bought Apple at the IPO, you would have to suffer 90% drawdowns. But hey, if you held on, look where Amazon is today. And it's like, yes, I get that. But at the same time, those are only stories from survivors. You don't hear the stories of the companies that IPO'd, went down 90%, and then went bankrupt. Right. And I just think that there's a lot of corollaries between these World War II stories and then these, you know, stock business model stories where, you know, just because Amazon went down 90% from the IPO doesn't mean that, oh, you know, hey, if I held the stock and it goes down 90%, at least I can rest assured because that happened to Amazon. I just think there's a dangerous trap there.
Yeah, absolutely. People would much rather tell you the story about how rich they got rather than the story of, you know, the investment that ruined their life. There are some of those stories out there, but I think for us, we can learn more from the stories about the losers, the declines, the stocks that didn't work out than we can the winners. In any degree of high success, if someone is very successful, you know, cases of extreme success, the odds that luck played at least some significant role increase with the degree of success. So the stories that we tend to tell, the books that we tend to read, tend to profile the extreme outliers of success.
Yeah,
which those tend to be the cases that we cannot fully replicate ourselves and try to learn from, because there's a degree of luck that fueled it. Not 100% luck most of the time, but some degree of it that is easy for us to overlook. Whereas the cases of extreme failure, someone going bankrupt, a business not working, those tend to be more often than not cases, not always, but they tend to be more often than not just mistakes that they made, poor risk management, huge decisions of swinging for the fences that we can learn from. We can read those stories and say, okay, here's what not to do. Here's something to learn from. So those failures that we don't hear from as often tend to actually be more instructive than the wins.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's a book out there that's just dedicated almost like your style, where it's like, you know, every chapter is just a different company that failed and why they failed. If that's out there and someone's listening, please let me know. If not, maybe that's a book idea for number three or number one for myself.
there's a book by Michael Matnick called Big Mistakes, where he profiles some of the best investors like Ben Graham and Warren Buffett and the worst investments that they made. And he profiles how they made the decisions and whatnot. So I think more of that is really necessary in the world.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, and now I kind of want to pivot to, and this is really scratching at my own itch because, you know, I know when I emailed you this outline, I basically told you, hey, look, I'm really struggling here because I feel like you've been on every podcast. You've been on these big podcasts and I'm this small little operation. You know, you've been on Shane Paris, you know, all these great podcasts. I'm like, what do I ask this guy that hasn't been asked already? And, you know, I messaged Alex from Macropsies, you know, the guy I work with, and he's like, just scratch your itch. And so from a writer interviewing another writer, I'm like, all right, I'm just going to scratch my itch and go down this tunnel. So you said that you had really had zero writing experience before joining The Motley Fool, which is, I guess, one of your first jobs outside of college. I mean, I know you might've started it during college or something like that, but yeah. How did you go from zero to one to really improve your writing? Because I know that there's a steep learning curve there.
Yeah. Well, first I would say I really appreciate you asking me other questions than I've already been asked before.
Well, that's what I tried to do. Yeah. I had to take a walk because I couldn't figure it out.
I mean, the biggest explanation that I would give you of starting at The Motley Fool as at that point, a professional writer when I had never written anything before, I had no writing background, but now I'm getting paid to write every day. The biggest explanation I'll give you is at first the writing was awful. That's the explanation. How did I get from zero to one? It was by writing really bad stuff that I crossed my fingers that the editors would at least put up with. Wow. And then over time, and by time I mean years, if you do something every day, you're going to get better at it, no matter what it is. So the first couple of years were just grinding out. And what's interesting about writing online too, particularly back in the days where all the articles had comment sections.
Yeah.
Is that if you write a bad article, people will let you know in no uncertain terms what was wrong with that article and why it was poorly written. They will tell you and they will rub it in your face. So as a writer, if you're reading the comment sections on your own articles, there's a lot of feedback, very quick, very blunt, honest feedback. And I think as you go through the years, and it does take years, you just start realizing, okay, that article actually did pretty well. What did I do in that article that was different? That article definitely didn't work. People hated that article. What can I learn from that?
Right.
Even if it's not conscious like that, I think you just kind of figure out what works and what doesn't. And also for me, and this is true for every writer, I'm a big reader. I think every professional writer is a big reader themselves. And I know what I want to read and what I don't. I know from books and articles that other people wrote that I read and I say, oh, I really loved this writing style. I really loved how they tackled this problem. And again, I think it's subconscious, but what can I learn from that? How can I emulate what they did? And the opposite, God, that book was so dense. I hated reading that. He just rambled on. Okay, yeah. How can I make sure I do not do that in my own, right? So I don't think there's no tricks to give you. There's no hacks, I would say, other than just grinding it out through experience, which isn't that true for every field? That there's no hacks. There's no learning hacks. It's just, how did you get competent in what you did? You just put in the time, put in the effort. And during those early years when you have no idea what you're doing, it's hard. And it's brutal, particularly for me, because this was my first job out of college. This was like 2008, where if you lost your job, good luck getting a new one. No one's hiring in 2008. The economy's falling to pieces.
Right.
Which gave me a lot of paranoia about how do I hold on to this job that I don't know what I'm doing at. And there might not be another job for me if I lose it. So it was a hard, I look back at the period as like a lot of stress, but maybe that stress is like what made me try as hard as I can to learn to get better at it.
So then who were some of your early writers that you tried to mimic? I know you said that, you know, you would find a book or you'd find an author that you really liked. Do you remember any of those authors that you initially said, you know, I'm going to try to mimic this guy's style or this girl's style?
You know, nothing rings a bell. I think a classic answer, Michael Lewis, even before I started writing, was always just, man, this is so clear and such a good story. So I don't know if I tried to emulate that because I don't think anyone can emulate what he does. But
yeah,
I think, you know, even if individual names don't come to mind, but I think what I always tried to emulate because I realized it was what I like to read was short sentences, little words, easy words, just get your point across. Everyone knows that using big words to look smart is the worst thing you can do as a writer. Everyone yep. knows that, but it's yep. so hard to avoid temptation as a writer. It's so easy to be like, oh, here's a big word, here's a complicated sentence because I'm so smart. I got such a big brain, I can use my big words. That's tempting to do, even if you know it. But once you avoid that, and to have this counterintuitive idea in your head of like, I want to write like a third grader. I'm going to write this article a third grader can understand it. That's good writing. That's where good writing comes from. To me, I always think the winner for writing is a person who can say the most amount of stuff in the fewest words. it's not that you're just using short words because you're writing it in a basic way. It's taking something that is very complicated and explaining it with simple words in a way that does not erase any of the substance of what you're writing about. That's the trick. Mm-hmm. Here's one person who I think does this better than anyone, I think, is Bill Bryson, who's written okay. many books. And he's written a lot of, I guess, what you would consider to be pop history books. And I know that Bill Bryson is looked down upon by academic historians because Bill Bryson is not really a historian. He's not an academic historian from a pop perspective, but he sells a million times as many books as any of the academics. And the reason is because he writes in such a clear, coherent, non-rambling, accessible style that the academic historians cannot do. So I think they don't understand why Bill Bryson is so popular and so famous if he's not actually breaking, you know, finding new history. And the reason is because he's a better writer than anyone else. I think it's true for, who's the guy who wrote the book Sapiens?
I can check real quick.
Noah Yuval.
It is, Yuval Noah Harari.
Thank you. He too, I think that book now has sold about 10 million copies. Wow. And if you talk to like academic anthropologists, they will criticize that book because they will say, and this is true, there is absolutely no new information in that book. He did not discover anything. There are no new ideas. There are no new frameworks. Everything in that book is from other people. So why does it sell 10 million copies? The reason is because it's written very well. It's good reading. It's good writing. He says a lot in the few words, and it doesn't take a lot of mental bandwidth. It doesn't take a lot of mental horsepower to understand the points that he's trying to make, which a lot of anthropologists, it's the opposite. They write an academic white paper, and you read the abstract, and you say, what the hell are you even talking about? I don't even know what your thesis is here. This is so wordy and jargon-filled. So that, to me, is always the essence of good writing. And it's counterintuitive because you would think in most fields, like the people who are the best are the people who understand the complexity. And for writing, it's opposite. The people who are the best are the people who understand the basic, you know, really simplistic style of what they're trying to get across.
Yeah. And it's just, man, there's so much good stuff that I could pull from there. And honestly, it goes right into this idea, because I think finance and investing is one of those industries that's prone to this, look at my big brain, look at all these words that I can use, these complex formulas. When in reality, it's kind of like what you said, it goes back to Peter Lynch, is like, can you explain this to a fourth grader or a third grader, why you own this stock or why you own this business? And to me, that's true knowledge, true understanding of a company. You don't need a 40 to 50 page, you know, slide deck or research report. And it goes back to an interview that you did where you said a lot of writing these days comes from the academic culture, where there's maximum lengths that you have to get, where it's like, you know, write about X in at least 6 pages, instead of the other way around, where it's, you know, hey, write about X in at most 2 pages.
Right.
And so with that as kind of this framework, I do want to dive into this idea of investment writing and really how to craft a better investment thesis. And so one of the things is, I don't know how much writing you did about specific companies at the Motley Fool. And I know at the Collaborative Fund, it's not necessarily like company specific, at least what you publish on the blog. But I do want to ask, like, what do you think makes a great investment pitch, coming from a writer's perspective where you want concise and short? What does that look like for you?
I think it's a combination of two things. One is, for anything to be a good investment, it has to be, your thesis has to be out of consensus, and it has to be right. Those are the two things that you need to do. Because if it is out of consensus and wrong, well, then that doesn't work. And if it is right but in consensus, then it might either. So it needs to be one. Your thesis has to be, or the ultimate outcome has to be one of those two. I think what's important for a pitch, though, is that. For most successful investments, and this is really true in a pitch where you're trying to get someone's attention and trying to persuade them that you're right. For most successful investments, the actual cause of the outcomes is usually driven by one or two variables. So if you were to look at, you know, an investing pitch, and it goes through a ton of different details about the company's balance sheets and this, and then goes into grand detail and intricate detail, most of the time that's not actually going to be what matters in the investment. What matters in the investment is just like a couple of broad trends, one or two broad trends, macro trends. Here's one example. Think about Amazon in the last 15 or 20 years. Think about this investment pitch 20 years ago where they're trying to convince you to buy Amazon. They might look at the company's working capital ratios and dig deep into its balance sheet and all these intricate metrics. The only thing that mattered though was Prime and AWS. That's it. If you wrote an investment pitch 20 years ago, I don't think AWS even existed. So let's say 10 years ago. And if you just wrote your investment thesis that said, Prime is going to attract a lot of customers and AWS is going to capture a lot of market, period. That's the end of my investing thesis. In hindsight, that was all you needed. That was right.
Yeah.
No pitch is going to have that. Every pitch, particularly at the professional level, is going to be 100 pages of deep analysis about company trends. And that stuff just doesn't matter. So for me, what is important in any investment pitch that I'd be looking at is just the simplicity of the of one or two very one or two variables that have the potential to be extremely powerful versus 100 variables that at the individual level probably don't move the needle much, if at all.
I love that. And so now at the collaborative fund, then what was the best pitch that you've personally sat in? Because I'm always interested in you know, people's perspectives in terms of investments and stuff like that. I mean, even, you know, if this is something where you can even answer, so let me know or not, but like, what was the best pitch that you saw from a recent example?
Yeah. So let me give you two of companies that we did invest in. One is a company called Dandelion Energy, which makes geothermal heating and cooling systems for residential homes. Geothermal digs a massive bore in your backyard, pulls up heat and air from the depths of the earth to heat and cool your house. It's a really cool company. And the pitch was basically, I mean, it was more in depth than this, but the pitch was basically geothermal energy is good for the environment because it doesn't burn any fossil fuels. And it is cheaper for consumers because we've gotten the system down to the point where we can install it cheaply. And after it's installed, there's no ongoing expenses. So that's the thing. Better for the environment and is actually cheaper for consumers. We're not asking people to make a financial sacrifice in order to save the planet. We're saying, right. Hey, not only are you saving the planet, but we're going to save you money too.
Yep.
Once you have those two things, once people can do something good and save money at the same time, off to the races. And so that, that again, that's the two variables that matter. Good for the world, better for your pocketbook. Boom, we're all in this. Let's go. The other is Beyond Meat, which makes, you know, meat-free burgers and whatnot. Like the perfect pitch, and they came into the office, they came in with burgers, and they said, they fried them up, and they said, take a bite of this. It tastes like meat, doesn't it? And we said, yeah, it tastes like meat. That's great. Let's invest. That was the other thing. It was not, we're making meat-free burgers so that we can save the planet. That's a part of it. But the biggest pitch to consumers was this actually tastes like a burger. This is not a Boca burger that tastes like straw and dirt, whatever else yeah. they taste like. Fine. This is actually, like, we're not asking you to make a sacrifice when you eat these. So that's the other thing. And again, that just gets back to a couple of variables. Do we invest in Dandelion Energy because we had a really intricate analysis of where geothermal energy is going? No, nothing like that. We invested it because the two variables, good for the planet, save you money, boom. That's all we need to hear. We're in. So it tends to be the really simple pitches like that I always enjoy.
It's actually interesting that you bring up Beyond Meat, because as soon as you said the Dandelion Energy and this idea that you can, you know, help save the environment, but you know, you're not reducing you know, like your actual ability to enjoy your life. It's not like you're sacrificing or anything like that. And I think I listened to it on How I Built This with Guy Raz, the founder of Beyond Meat, was on there. And he basically said, look, the only way to actually win with, you know, this meat transition and to get us off of meat as a society is to create something that's better than the alternative, and then to let capitalism do its work. It's not to, you know, kind of guilt trip you into saying, oh, you should help this. It's like, actually, no, create a product that's better, and then let capitalism naturally, if you want to use that invisible hand, you know, let's take the meat users and then take the invisible hand over to the better product. And then there you go.
Right. I mean, what's interesting for veggie burgers, they've been around for decades. Boca Burgers, Morningstar, like it's nothing new, but they always asked you to make a sacrifice. They didn't even pretend that they were going to taste like a hamburger. There was something very different, and most of them taste awful. But that was actually okay for them, because their pitch was not, this is a delicious burger. Their pitch was, you're not killing animals, and this is better for the planet. That was their pitch. But they were asked, but again, they're asking you to make a sacrifice, which you can't do. You're not going to be a huge multi-billion-dollar company if you ask people to make a sacrifice. So back to Dandelion Energy. What percentage of the population wants to fight against global warming? Huge. I don't know what it is, but the vast majority would be like, yes, I want to save the planet. I'd like to do what I can. But then if you went to people and said, okay, we have a new heating and cooling system from your house, but it's going to double energy bills. But hey, you're saving the planet. Most people in that situation would say, oh, no, like, right. I'm not into that. Once Dandelion can say, we're going to wipe out your energy bills, we're going to save you money, people are like, oh, well, that's that checks both the boxes for me. This is great.
So then how do we fix, and this is going to be a loaded question, but, you know, I figured that you'd be one of the, you know, perfect people to ask. How do we fix this desire to have more information presented to us and have these big complex models? Like, is it MBA and business schools that are kind of at fault here for having these graduates come out and focusing on complex models to the decimal point instead of really shifting that focus to big, simple drivers?
I think it's always going to be there because, I mean, a lot of it, and this might sound cynical, but I think it's true. A lot of it is just people trying to justify their salaries. Look, if you are a consultant and you earn a very good salary, if you are a product manager at a company, and if you turn in a report to your boss or to your client that is one paragraph long, people are gonna say, why are we paying you 300 grand a year? What is this? This is all you can produce. Yeah. But if you turn in something that's 100 pages with a bunch of jargon that people don't understand, people will be like, see, this is why we hire you. You're a smart person. So a lot of it is just salary justification. I think that's really true. Even if it, because it's not intuitive to think that the stuff that really matters might be able to be explained in a sentence or in a paragraph. It doesn't seem like that's intuitive. I mean, most fields do have a correlation between effort and results. Like in sports, for example, like you want to get good at golf, go to the range for 8 hours a day. That's how you get better.
Yeah.
So in most fields, the correlation between there is positive. But for a lot of things, in investing and in business, it's the opposite. It's the harder that you try, the worse you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is because what I said earlier about the one or two variables that make all the difference. If you are putting in a ton of effort into your investment decisions and you're like, man, I put in 6 months of diligence trying to figure this investment out. But if you miss the one variable that moves the needle, doesn't matter.
Yep.
And on the other hand, if you spend 30 minutes researching this, if you spend 30 minutes researching a company and you do get that one variable that matters, that's all you need to. It's all you need. Doesn't make a difference.
Yeah.
So I think in a world where things are driven by tail events, and one or two variables, one or two companies, one or two things drives the majority of outcomes, then, you know, simple explanations are all you need, as long as your simple explanation captures what matters. And complexity doesn't make a difference if your complexity does not capture the one or two variables that make a difference. So I actually don't think we're ever going to move away from that, because it's not intuitive and people can't justify their salaries to get there.
Yeah. I love what you said there at the end where, you know, complexity, if you have complexity but miss those two drivers, your complexity counts for nothing. Or nothing. Right. And there's no complexity premium. And, you know, I don't know if this is correlation equals causation type thing, but, you know, it tends to be that some of the best investment ideas that any investor has tend to be the ones that are the no-brainers that actually don't take that long. It's you look at a company and you're like, wow, what am I missing? This thing looks stupid cheap. And then you spend a few minutes, maybe a week or so, looking at this thing and saying, you know what? No, this checks all the boxes. Let me buy it. And the only big example I have of that is I got to chat with a fund manager who, you know, is based out of Annapolis here in Maryland, I'm in Georgia now, but Maryland's where I live. And he was going over his thesis on Microsoft back when Microsoft was trading at, like, you know, 12 times earnings X cash. And in his shareholder letter, it was 1 to 2 paragraphs of why Microsoft is going to be a great investment over the next 10 years at the price he bought it. And he said, Brandon, like, look, this is what I thought, and this is what was going on, and I don't need to share anything else.
Yeah. And there's another side of this too, in that, you know, let's go back to Amazon. Let's say that you bought Amazon 10 years ago because of some complex thesis that you had. Well, look, that investment has worked out very well for you. The stock's done very well. But the reason it's has done well might not have had anything to do with your complex thesis. The reason it's done well is because of AWS and Prime. That's it. So that's it can fool a lot of people as well. That, you know, kind of the fooled by randomness idea from Taleb of doing very well, but maybe the thing that worked out well was not because of why you were right for the wrong reason. That can really fool a lot of people. And it fools particularly the people that have a complex strategy, a complex thesis about where the world is going that turns out right. And they think, oh, look, I was right because I'm so smart and I made this complex model. Even if no, what actually drove what was important in the world was one or two really simple things.
Yep. One of the other aspects of scratching my own itch was getting to understand your research funnel from the top down. And I know when I talk to a lot of investors, one of the first things I'm interested in is how they source ideas for investments. And when going through thinking about questions that I would ask you, I was like, man, how does this guy come up with these blog ideas? And I know that you, in previous interviews, you said, you know, you like to spend a lot of your time reading, and during the week, your actual writing is a very small portion of that overall week. But one of the things I've always wondered is, what is that filter look like from the top? And so my first question is, you know, what do you read? How do you decide to read it? And then how has your reading material changed over time?
I would say my strategy for reading is I try to cast the widest net that I can. So I will start reading anything that I think looks even remotely interesting that people recommend to me, or that I come across, whether it's a book or an article or a research report. If it strikes me in the slightest way, let's try to make time to read it. But then yeah, I have a really strong filter. So even though I start reading a lot of things, I quit them very quickly if I realize like, no, this isn't working for me, which is no offense against the author, but like, no, I'm not going to get anything out of this. Maybe that's a skill that takes years to acquire, like having a strong filter to realize what's not going to work. But I think that's how it has to be. If you only read books that you know with 100% certainty you're going to like, you're going to miss a lot of things that you didn't realize that you might not have, that might have been interesting for you, particularly from other fields that you're not that aware of. You know, I read a lot of biology and physics and things about evolution and whatnot that I have no expertise in the slightest. But if it's a little bit interesting to me, I'll start reading that stuff, like physics. Like, this is over my head. This is not going to work. I'm not going to get anything out of this. But there's other things that I wouldn't have thought in a million years that I would enjoy, that I start reading. And I'm like, this is changing my view on the world. I really enjoy this. And so if I had not given myself permission to cast a wide net and read something that I would never think that I would actually enjoy, you would never find that stuff. So that's always been my overarching strategy, is just cast a wide net and have a strong filter. I think the hardest part of that is the filter. And mine has gotten pretty good, where I've quit books after three sentences. You read three sentences at the start of a book, how? And it's like, nope, this
how?
Is not
working. How does that work?
I mean, I think it's similar to like dating someone. If you go on a blind date with someone, you can probably know within 10 seconds whether it's going to work or not. 10 seconds, that's all you need. For a book, of just the way that the author puts himself out there and gets your attention in the first sentence, you can just say, look, you and I don't see eye to eye here. This is not going to work. Now, I think that's okay. No issue with that.
Yeah.
But I think that's always been really important for me.
So then in that light, how do you then check yourself for confirmation bias? Because I know one of the things that you like to talk about a lot is this idea of confirmation bias and making sure that you're keeping that in check. And just from my perspective, if I like, let's say I take the first three sentences and I say, you know what, we don't see eye to eye here. How do I then reconcile the fact where I could be then funneling only ideas that I agree with down to what I read? Does that make sense? Or am I thinking about it wrong?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. I would say, I think almost no one, including me, is actually that. I think confirmation bias is one of those we're all aware of. We know it exists, but can we actually fight it? Probably not. That may sound like just giving up, but I think that's by and large true. If there's one thing that I've tried to do, and I use the word try because I don't know if I'm actually that great on this, is I try to find people who I agree with them on some topics, but not others. Because if I agree with them on some topics, then I know they're not crazy. I know they're a smart person who's thinking I admire because I agree with them on X. But if I disagree with them about Y, well, look, if I know you're not crazy, then I'm much more likely to listen to you rather than just writing you off as a quack. Which, look, there are a lot of people who I disagree with them on virtually everything, and I can just write them off. Like, look, it's not working here. But there are a few friends that I have who, without naming them, I'll give you some examples. People for whom I really agree with how they think about the economy and the stock market. I think they have very sharp financial views, but I completely disagree with them about politics. Those are the people who I want to talk with politics about, because the fact that I agree with them about the economy means I know you are a smart person. I know you're not crazy. I know you're good. So that's who I want to listen to. There are other people whose political views, or, you know, their views, I don't agree with anything about it. So I'm not going to listen to their political views either, because I just need to say, look, we're different people. It's fine. Let's go our own ways. So I think that's what you have to do to try to be open-minded, is to find someone who you agree with on some things, but not others. It makes it easier to not just write that person off to begin with.
Now, when you're reading this broad selection of ideas and frameworks and different studies, at what point do you usually find yourself thinking, you know what, okay, this can be an article? Like, what is like what is that point? Is it where you read something in physics and then it clicks in like behavioral finance? Or, you know, how do you then reckon, or I guess quantify that, you know, moment where the synapses connect?
I would say, look, there are a lot of times when I think I found an idea, and in my head I'm like, ah, this is an article. And then you think about it a little more, or even you start writing it and you realize like, nah, this isn't working. Like, I thought this might be interesting, but it's not. What's difficult to answer that question is this. Everything that I write, I think this is true for virtually all writers. When I start writing it, I have no idea where it's going to go. Yeah. It's not that I have a fully formed idea in my head and then true. I sit down and write it. It's never that.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's this really vague idea about, oh, I think this is kind of a neat finance idea. Let's see where it goes. And then you write one sentence and you're like, oh, that reminds me of this. Like, maybe I could write that. And then you write a paragraph and you think, oh, like, I didn't even realize that reminds me of this other thing. So I don't actually think there's ever a light bulb moment where you think, here's an article idea I have. Because that kind of implies that you have the whole article in your head already. And it's never that. Which gets to this idea that writing is more than about communication. Writing is about thinking. It's a thinking process. And a lot of people will look at writers that they admire and think, how did you know all this, or something like, how did you have all this information in your head that you wrote in a book? And the answer is always, they did not have all that information in their head. They started writing it, and in the process of writing it, they figured this stuff out through research or just cranking the gears in their head. They kind of forced it out. Which is, brings up a different point, but I think it's important, which is that writing is a good thing for, I think, virtually everyone to do in any field, even if you're not writing publicly, even if you're just writing for yourself, because it helps you clarify a lot of the thoughts that you have in your head in any field. These vague ideas that you have floating around in your head that when you're forced to put them on the paper, they become clearer for you. Clear either in a good way and you understand them better, or clear in a way that once you put them on the paper, you realize like, oh, that actually doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And I should try to abandon that idea. It's a really helpful process.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just one of those things that you mentioned where you don't have all the information when you're writing the article. And I just think back to, I guess one way that I've tried to gauge my improvement as a writer is being able to recall different things and different models and frameworks into one cohesive idea. And if I'm able to pull from more places and make everything actually relatable within a story, within a concise story, then that's how I'm improving as a writer. You know, most recently this morning I was working on a piece for Roku, and it was like, you know, Roku reminds me of Square's early days because I read, you know, The Innovation Stack by Jim McKelvey, and that was just something, you know, there. And it's like, oh, well, you know, the model can also be thought of as like a razor and a razor blade thing. And that's from an article that I, you know, wrote back in 2019. And then I just sat there and I thought, well, then that also makes me think of platforms as like buffets at restaurants, where Roku isn't actually buying and cooking the food. They're having restaurants come to the buffet and pay them for a place at the buffet table. And I was like, this is just kind of cool. I mean, I know, you know, it's not like every article is like that. I wish it was, but it's just a good thing to kind of keep away in the cookie jar and say, you know what? Okay. I have had these connections before.
Yeah. And I think the more reading that you do, the more writing that you do, you just build up a library of random unstructured ideas and anecdotes in your head that over time adds up to something that you can pull from quite a bit as you're doing your writing.
So I'm going to ask you probably the most loaded question of this entire podcast, but how has writing changed your life?
Good question. I mean, the most obvious way is I turned it into a career. So it's everything for me. It's how I support my family. It's everything. So that's the obvious answer. But in general too, I think it's made me more empathetic to the idea that there are a lot of things in the world that I don't agree with, but I still understand why other people think them, because that's what writing has done for me. I've gone through the process of having these vague ideas that I have in my head. And when I write them out, I realize that no, actually the vague idea that I had in my head was completely wrong. And other people have that too. So people who I disagree with, people who have ideas that I don't think are right, rather than in a previous life, I would have criticized that person for their poor thinking, their dumb ideas. Now I realize virtually all the ideas that all of us have are incomplete. Our vague thoughts are not really structured properly. Very few ideas anyone has is like a cohesive, well thought out thesis that they have in their head. It's just not how people think.
Yep.
People just have vague ideas that come out in ways that are inarticulate, that sound bad when they come out. So I just become a little bit more empathetic to bad ideas because I realize that my own ideas are all bad when I put them onto paper too. And they need a lot of help once they're on paper to make them coherent. So that's, I would say from a broader perspective, that's what writing has taught me.
I like that. And now, you know, I know we're trying to keep this within an hour, so I'm going to just jump to our closing questions. And, you know, I normally ask, you know, the kind of standard, hey, where can people find you and stuff like that. I mean, gosh, I think everybody in FinTwit follows you on Twitter right now. So they know what your Twitter handle is. But I did have a couple questions that I thought would be interesting for others here because I know that I'm interested in there. So if you could have one writer write your biography, who would it be and why?
Oh, good question. There is a writer named Robert Kirsten. I've spoke about him a little bit. He wrote the book Shadow Divers and Rocket Men and a few other books. He's not as well known as Michael Lewis, but I think I genuinely think he's a better writer than Michael Lewis, which is nothing against Michael Lewis. It just shows how much I admire Robert Kirsten. I think his ability to tell a story, the crispness of his writing, his ability to keep you engaged is better than anyone I've come across. And I think the test of that is the topics that he writes about tend to be pretty boring, but he writes them so well. He does such a good job telling the story that you can't put the book down, which that to me is like the mark of a good writer is when you can make a boring topic really exciting. Mm-hmm. So just from a pure, just raw writing skill, I admire him the most. But maybe the right answer is my wife because she knows me the best and she knows where all the skeletons are buried, so to speak. In good biography, that's what you want. You don't want it to be what's the word when a biography is just building up hagiography? I think is a phrase of it. When a biography is just showing you the good stuff, a real biography shows you the bad. So maybe it should be my wife is the right answer for that.
nice cover there. Now, if you could have dinner. So this is actually a question I ask every guest. So I'm interested to hear your answer here. So if you could have dinner with anyone from the past or the present, doesn't have to be finance, investing related or anything like that, who would it be and why?
Maybe this is not a very exciting answer, but I think Franklin Roosevelt probably had the most interesting life of any American in modern history because he was front and center of the two biggest events in modern history, the Great Depression and World War II. And he not only saw how those things played out in greater detail than virtually anyone else, but he had the biggest role in influencing their direction than almost anyone else in the world. So I think because those two events were so fundamental to everything that you and I and everyone else deal with today, I would want his perspective too. He has this great quote near the end of his life where I might butcher this a little bit, but it's near the end of his life. And he sits down with a group of historians and he says something to the effect of, you know, all of you people think that you know what has happened in my life, but you know hardly anything. So he's something like that, which I always think is interesting. There's 1,000 books written on Churchill and FDR and Eisenhower and all these people, but we know like 1% of what actually they said and what happened in their life. So to sit down with them over beers and try to get the truth out of them, I think would be so incredibly fascinating.
Yeah. We haven't had FDR. We've had other presidents and stuff, you know, like Lincoln and things like that. But no, I mean, great answer. And have you seen the Netflix special, The Roosevelts, where it kind of captured? I love that. Yeah, I'm a big Teddy Roosevelt fan. So,
but this gets back to my point. The documentary is so good and so detailed about their lives, but we know that is a fraction of 1% of what there is to actually know about them. So that's what I find most interesting.
Yep, I'm still waiting for a full feature Teddy Roosevelt film. That man's life, gosh, like the fact that that's not a film yet blows my mind. But Morgan, thank you so much for coming on the show. This is honestly a bucket list item for me, so I am really, really stoked that I could get you on the show and just get a chance to pick your brain and selfishly scratch my itch.
This has been a lot of fun for me too, so thank you for having me. I appreciate it.